Judge Sleater, Judge Ross, Judge Kalikowski, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals. September 18, we have six matters on our calendar, four oral and two non-oral. We start first with the file Donald L. Bryant respondent, Joshua W. Bryant, senior appellant, and A190359 is our file number. As counsel are both aware, each party will be allowed 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal if it's necessary. We do ask that you pay attention as best you can to the timing and lights on the podium so you can adhere to those. And when you do approach the podium, if you would state your name and record for our record, we appreciate that. I believe the podium can be adjusted to if necessary. And when appellant's ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Jeffrey Ali, and I'm from Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Joshua Bryant. May it please the court. This is a very simple case. It involves a dispute between father and son, landlord and tenant. The father, landlord, let the son rent a place at the father's house rent-free. They both agreed that the son would pay no rent. As the father testified at the lockout trial preceding this case, which became part of the record here, question, Josh moved in with you in the second half of June of this year. That was 2018, 18th of June. All right, and you let him move in rent-free? Answer, yes. Okay, and there's no written lease? Answer, there was no lease, and no, it just, I wanted to have a place for him to live and his children not to have to visit him in a halfway house. That was the reason why that all came about. That's at A18, page 18 of the appendix of appellant's brief. Then there was a dispute, family dispute, between father and son and other members of the family. The father went to family court to get an order for protection, which was granted ex parte. The son, before I met the son and began representing the son, Joshua Bryant, got that vacated, pro se. Then the father changed the locks on the son. We went to court. The housing court ruled in a lockout case from which I just read that the son should not have been locked out. The father locked out the son illegally. The whole point of the lockout was whether the father was legally allowed to change the locks and lock the son out, whether there was a landlord relationship, and if so, if the father then had to follow the landlord-tenant laws. The court ruled yes. The court said in paragraph 2, this is at A6 and A7 of the appendix, plaintiff is a tenant at the property. Paragraph 5, tenant pays no rent. Tenant occupied the property as a tenant at will and took possession on June 18, 2018. The court ruled because of that landlord-tenant relationship, the father could not lock the son out, and the court ordered repossession of the property. Paragraph 14, on November 15, 2018, the court found landlord had actually or constructively excluded tenant from property, the property as of October 17, 2018, and ordered landlord to allow tenant back into the property. I'm reading from the decision, that's paragraph 14 at A7. Then the father continued to try to get the son out of the house. First, he tried the lockout. Then he filed an eviction. Okay, eviction one, we're here as a result of eviction two, but in eviction one, the father tried to evict the son after having given a 14-day notice to vacate. It says, get out of the property in 14 days.
Do you believe that the issue of whether the landlord-tenant law applies is before this court in this decision today?
Yes. I mean, the housing court ruled in three different cases.
My question is, do you believe that it's an issue for us to resolve whether landlord-tenant applies to the situation?
If Your Honor's asking if the question, which has been raised by the respondent, although not appealed, is whether the son is a tenant or a tenant at will, no, that issue is not before the court because that issue has been decided and has not been appealed. But do the landlord-tenant laws apply? Yeah, absolutely. That's what the reason we're here for, is to determine whether or not under Minnesota Statute 504B.135, whether sub A of that statute applies or whether sub B of that statute applies. Sub A provides that in a tenancy at will, 90 days notice, or actually 3 months notice, must be given to the tenant as a notice to vacate. Sub B says, in a case in which the tenant has failed or neglected or refused to pay rent due, the landlord can give 14 days notice to vacate. So what happened, eviction one, the court ruled this is a tenancy at will, there's no rent due. The son was supposed to be provided 90 days notice or 3 months notice to vacate. In eviction two, what the landlord did is then the landlord presented a unilateral demand for rent to the son, saying, okay, I lost eviction one, but now you're going to be required to pay me $1,200 a month in rent, and if you don't, you got to be out within 14 days. Rent due under the statute means rent that the parties have previously agreed would be due, pursuant to an agreement that rent would be due. This was a manufactured unilateral demand for rent that the son never agreed to pay. The parties never previously agreed would be due. Yet the housing court in this eviction two case ruled, well, the son didn't pay the rent, he didn't get out in 14 days, therefore I'm going to evict him. So the question is, does sub A of the statute apply or does sub B of the statute apply?
Mr. Ali, were you able to identify, or can you identify any law that prohibits a landlord from switching a no-rent tenant at will to a rent tenant at will?
There's nothing in the law that prevents a landlord from asking a tenant to new terms, right? To agree to new terms. But there is nothing providing that the landlord can change up unilaterally the terms of a tenancy without the tenant's agreement. So in response to your question, Your Honor, the statute is clear that in a tenancy at will, right, 90 days or 3 months notice has to be given. Okay, at that point, the landlord can evict the tenant, file a case for holdover in housing court, and in the interim, if the landlord wants to present a tenant with a new agreement, the landlord can certainly do that, and then the tenant has the right to accept or refuse that new agreement, the new set of terms. There's no case involving these set of facts, and I would infer respectfully, because this is such an easy case, the law is so clear, the statute is so clear, that no one does this, right? Or tenants not understanding their rights get out, right? But the fundamental flaw in the housing court's analysis in this case, and this is the basis on which, the sole basis on which the housing court based its decision in this case, is the housing court almost ignored, or maybe even implicitly acknowledged, that the notice was facially defective and illegal on its face, because it didn't give 90 days. But then the housing court goes on to say, be that as it may, the tenant agreed to the demand for rent. Why? Not because he paid, not because he said he would pay, but because he didn't vacate. Well, he didn't vacate because he was legally entitled to 90 days under the law, and we were litigating the issue before that court and now before this court. So it's very curious, the reasoning. The housing court, almost kind of by operation of law, infers that, well, if the tenant doesn't get out after a unilateral demand for rent, whether or not there was a basis for that demand for rent, then the tenant has implicitly accepted that demand for rent. No, the tenant hasn't accepted that demand for rent. The tenant is fighting that in court. And the three cases, the one case the housing court cited, and the two additional cases that the respondent cites, are cases in which, yeah, parties agreed, you know, the landlord said, oh, I want you to start doing this now. And the tenant actually did start doing that. The one case involved Gardner case, 1874. It's an 1874 case. The issue was holdover. It wasn't even holdover, but the facts, the underlying facts in the case was that someone was renting, a landlord was renting commercial property to the city, right? And that for 3 years. The term expired, but the parties kept operating as if the lease was still in effect. So it was then, well, is it month to month? Is it year to year? Whatever. I think they were paying quarterly, okay? So I guess it was quarter to quarter. The landlord said at some point, I'm charging you $600 a month in rent, but I can't keep doing this. I need to charge you $800. And the city council passed some resolution or decided that they would pay the $800. And so they started paying $800. And so that case merely stands for the obvious proposition that if a party agrees to a change in terms, well, then they can't later on be heard to complain about those changing terms. But that case involved, well, what's the length now? Not what's the rent. There was no dispute in that case that the rent was $800 because they were paying $800. So I think that's the case the housing court cited for the proposition that Joshua Bryant accepted the demand for rent in this case. It's factually completely irrelevant and distinguishable.
Counsel, you suggested that the law is clear. Does the law stand for the proposition that any time a parent allows an adult child back in their home, they then have a landlord-tenant relationship and that child has all those rights of a tenant?
Not necessarily. I mean,
what's different about this case than any other case where a child moved home?
It would depend upon the facts.
I know. Give me some facts of this case that differs from a typical situation of an adult child moving back home.
Well, it depends if there's an understanding, right? So The factual scenario.
Well, the understanding you suggested was the father saying, I don't want his children to visit him in a halfway home so he can come here.
This is what I'm suggesting, Your Honor. There may be situations in which it is vague as to whether or not the parties have mutually agreed, whether there's been a meeting of minds as to whether or not the person's going to be a permanent resident or an occupant of a place or merely a guest. Okay? And what I'm saying is, in this case, we don't have any question as to whether or not Joshua Bryant was merely visiting or being permitted to stay there for a short period of time, or whether he was a resident there, right? As I said, and this wasn't developed any further because it wasn't an issue in the lockout or eviction one or eviction two. There was no lease. I wanted to have a place for him to live, okay? He's living there. He's got four kids there. He's got all his property there. He's got his furniture there. He eats his meals there. He's got his food there. He gets his mail. He's got all the indicia of being a resident, and there's no point to work that up further because it was not in dispute. Now, may there be situations where my daughter who goes to college near Cleveland comes back and wants to stay with us for a short period of time and then go back to school? Well, I mean, that's different.
What if your daughter doesn't, say she drops out of school and comes back home? Are you saying there has to be some express declaration that the residence is temporary, that you can come but you can't stay forever, that there actually must be something further that articulates that the distinction between a temporary residency and a permanent one?
No, what I'm saying is, you know, an analysis would have to be gone through, a record would have to be developed as to whether or not there are indicia of someone being a resident or someone merely being a guest. And so all I'm saying is I've listed some: getting mail, paying bills, preparing meals, having others in your family live with you.
What's the most persuasive case law you found that would allow for a tenancy relationship in a situation where a parent allows the child, adult child, to return home without rent?
Well, as I say, Your Honor, I didn't research all the cases out there defining what's a tenant and what's not a tenant, because Judge Referee Hotelling decided in three cases that this is a tenant. Joshua Bryant, my client, is a tenant. There was a tenancy at will. Wasn't appealed in the lockout case. That's the whole point of the lockout case. Wasn't appealed in eviction one. Not appealed now. So I do not have those cases off the top of my head because, frankly, respectfully, I don't think that's an issue in this case.
Well, I understand that, but it's been argued on appeal that it is an issue, and it's possible that we might agree that it was preserved sufficiently for our review. So even though you didn't have a basis to challenge, to raise the issue or argue the matter below, what cases have you found in preparing for this argument today that would counter the issue, that provide for the notion that a stay-at-home child or a returning child without paying rent is a tenant?
As I said, because it was admitted by the father and it was pled, in fact, in the complaint in this case by Mr. Kuhn, that the son was a tenant and the father was the landlord, I did not look into that. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
You have a rebuttal opportunity. Thank you, counsel, for respondent. You may approach and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Attorney Stephen Kuhn, C-O-O-N, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Donald Bryant. May it please the court. I would start by first addressing the question that you posed to opposing counsel as far as what issues are before the court. One of the main arguments of appellant in this matter as to why the lower court's ruling is incorrect is one of statutory interpretation of Minnesota statutes 504B-135, basically saying that the lower court misinterpreted a provision of that statute. It is not, we do not disagree with the fact that in this case, respondent did not appeal the dismissal of his first eviction, so that judgment and decision is not before the court, nor did respondent appeal the lower court's decision in the lockout matter. That decision is not before the court. However, the interpretation of 504B.135 certainly is before the court.
Well, the interpretation may be before the court, but my question is the issue of the status of the parties before the court, how was that preserved, that particular issue?
The issue, in my mind, is before the court because appellant's argument as to why the lower court misinterpreted the statute necessarily involves this court interpreting the entire statute, and it's simply my argument that this court is not bound by the lower court's interpretation of a provision of this statute.
Well, doesn't your client's eviction proceeding and the pleading that you offered to the district court to support eviction accept as true the tenancy relationship? I mean, frankly, I think your not a tenant argument is, I'm not sure the district court got that right. But it seems to me, at least where we stand now, that the pleading and the presentation of the case as an eviction, without raising the argument specifically that there was no tenancy relationship, has waived that issue, especially without providing a notice of related appeal. How do you respond to that?
Your Honor, on the one hand, I would argue that this court can certainly decide this matter without addressing whether or not The parties had a landlord-tenant relationship prior to the underlying facts in this current case that is before the court, in which case there's no dispute that a tenancy at will was created when there was a rent demand given. I think it's simply whether or not this court agrees or disagrees.
Let me put it a different way. Did you ever make the argument in the proceeding that is before us now that there was no tenancy relationship? Was that argument made in the district court in this eviction proceeding?
No, because the respondent intentionally created a landlord-tenant relationship by making a rent demand, thus thereby could terminate that tenancy with 14 days notice. So that's why there a new case was filed and that new relationship was created. So therefore, that became a moot point when a new eviction was filed and that was granted based on the new facts that we had created.
I gather you're saying that, no, you never raised a challenge to the district court about the relationship that had previously been established in the earlier proceedings, which is that there was a, according to the court, whether it was right or wrong, that there was a tenancy relationship between these parties.
I mean, to be clear, that issue was argued at the previous cases, but as this court is aware, evictions are a summary proceeding. The cheapest, most efficient manner in which respondent in this matter could attempt to remove his son from the home was creating the tenancy at will by the rent demand and then filing.
How is that the cheapest?
Excuse me?
How is that necessarily the cheapest way if the issue of the tenancy relationship could have been appealed in the previous proceeding and resolved in a in an argument before this court?
Well, it's more the timing, Your Honor, that there's, it can take months, obviously, to have a court of appeals render.
Well, and here we are. In the route that you took, the route that you took still put us here before the court of appeals. So it's not like you're saving any time. In fact, you added time by having an entire different, new eviction proceeding when you could have resolved it in the first eviction proceeding.
I'm troubled by the lack of route.
Pardon me?
The second route was effective in that the eviction was granted, and rather than sitting here today with appellate still residing at the house rent-free, he has now been out of the house the past 7 months. I think that's the main difference. So three main issues I think that this court needs to resolve to uphold the lower court's ruling, which is granting a judgment of eviction based on the narrow issue of whether or not there was proper notice given prior to the eviction. One is, did respondent father have a right to demand rent from his son? Two, did respondent father and son essentially create a tenancy at will with an agreement to pay rent? And third, did the lower court correctly apply the notice provisions of the statute 504B-135?
How would your argument differ, if at all, if instead of a tenancy relationship that being established, at least according, again, to the lower court, whether it was right or wrong, based upon a, hypothetically, a $1,000 a month relationship. Let's assume that instead of zero, it was $1,000. And otherwise, the facts are all the same, that your client did exactly what your client did, but instead of going from zero to, is it 1,200? Is that the?
Correct.
It was 1,000 to 1,200. Would your argument be the same?
Well, essentially, that would, if you just treat it as an assumption that appellate respondents already had a tenancy at will, I think Minnesota case law is clear in that situation. The landlord can make provide notice to the tenant that they are going to raise the rent and a tenancy at will, and if the tenant continues to reside there, then by staying at the property, that tenant has agreed to those new terms. And in that situation, the only question is, did the landlord provide the tenant appropriate notice to raise the rent, which would generally speaking be one interval as far as the rental period, saying going forward, you're going to have to start paying higher rent. So in essence, though, that is the situation we have here. There is a demand to start paying rent. And I think an existing tenant at will that's told that their rent's going to go up versus a new tenant that moves in, but the lease is determined to be void, but there was nonetheless a rent demand. Case law says that tenant, by staying there, has agreed to pay that amount of rent, and they can be evicted for not paying that amount of rent.
Mr. Kuhn, all the case law, at least that I've seen, identified with regard to acquiescing to a change or accepting presupposes a earlier contract with consideration that the parties had agreed upon. Do you see that as a major distinction factually here? It seems on its face, though the court made a finding there was a rental agreement, that there was no consideration provided by your client's son in this transaction. He was invited in.
Sure.
Hence, I'm assuming from that there would not be a contract, the elements of a contract. What is he acquiescing to? How does do you see the distinction? And I'm wondering, is that a fatal distinction from your client's standpoint of the decision or the conclusion made by the referee that there was acquiescence if there was never a contractual term to acquiesce to?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I think that the fact is just there was no prior contract for paying rent just means that there was no specific notice period that the respondent had to give to appellate to say, I'm going to start charging you rent. It's a gratuitous situation that you're allowing a family member to live with you. It's not a bargain. There is no consideration. So in this situation, the son has no right to say, we have a lease. You can't raise the rent or start charging me rent unless I agree. I think in that situation, it's simply in a gratuitous relationship. The one party who owns the home can say, I'm going to start charging you rent anytime it pleases them, because there is no agreement that a person can live somewhere for free indefinitely. Each day that they're there for free is with the permission of the owner. It's gratuitous, but there's no consideration that requires that to extend for any specific or indefinite period of time without changing.
So your point, would you believe then the referee did not need to reach the conclusion that your client's son acquiesced to it, but simply that he had notice of it and rent was due and it wasn't paid, hence the 14-day provision was the notice required?
Well, you don't have to necessarily use the word acquiesce, but I think it's in essence a determination that by virtue of receiving the notice of rent and then returning the property and staying there, by his conduct, that created a unilateral contract. And it doesn't mean that amount has to be negotiated. It doesn't mean that the appellant had to affirmatively agree with that amount of rent. It's simply that there was a rent demand, he was aware of it, and then he returned to the property and resided there. He was bound by it.
So in essence, then, the acquiescence element you're arguing simply does not apply in the situation where you have a rent-free tenant relationship.
I think acquiescence is a word that you can call it. In essence, it's acquiescence by him receiving the rent and acquiescing to the fact that I've received this rent and I'm continuing to stay here. I'm acquiescing to your rent demand, whether you call it acquiescence or that they have made a unilateral contract. I don't think that that's really significant. But the acquiescence, I think, comes just from this particular circumstance that this was the first time that rent was being demanded, which then changed the terms of the relationship, and he acquiesced to that fact by remaining at the property where he could have chosen to move out.
I'm just curious, acquiesce to what fact? That's what I'm lost on in your argument. What is the
acquiescing? He's acquiescing to the fact that by receiving a rent demand, he's agreeing to that rent demand when he moves in and stays there, and thereby that creates a tenancy at will with rent due once a month of $1,200, and then thereby subjects him to the provision in the statute where there is a tenancy at will with rent due and that rent is not paid, you can provide 14 days written notice to terminate that tenancy.
I'm just quickly again, I'm not sure what you're saying the acquiescence is to. Maybe, can you in one sentence just tell me what is the acquiescence to?
Acquiescence to the creation of a tenancy at will requiring payment of $1,200 a month per rent.
And what was the conduct that would demonstrate that that the younger Bryant was acquiescing to that as opposed to protesting that?
He moved back into the property and remained there for 3 months without, it's essentially the example of an at-will employee is told by their employer, effective immediately, I'm changing the structure of your pay. That employee continues to work there for 3 months. He can't later say, I never agreed to you changing my pay. I want the original pay that I was hired at. Well, you continue to work there for 3 months. You acquiesce to the employer telling you that I'm changing your pay. That's the nature of an at-will relationship.
What if Son had said, all right, I'm staying here, but I believe under the law I don't have to agree to the terms of your new proposed lease? Would that be acquiescence still if he was merely his presence in the home?
Your Honor, my time is up. Would you still like me to answer your question?
Yes, feel free to answer.
The issue is, I'm not saying that he preserved his legal right to say that in the situation the respondent didn't have a right to demand that he start paying rent, but if this court determines that the respondent did in fact have a right that he start paying rent, then the fact that he did it under protest makes no difference. There was an agreement to pay rent by him residing there after he received the rent demand.
Thank you. Counsel. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed with the rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's something that I want to make clear. It was briefed this way by the respondent, and it was reiterated right here. When Joshua Bryant, after the lockout decision, right, retook possession of the property, he was entitled to go back to the property, but he was already living at the property. He was restored possession of the property. There was no new tenancy at will created. So to the extent that the respondent has briefed this as if there was a new landlord-tenant relationship because of the lockout, that's wrong. Or because of anything Referee Hotelling said.
Well, I think the argument is not because of the lockout, but because of the return under the understanding that a $1,200 rent was being demanded. I think that's the argument.
But the $1,200 rent demand was a sham. It was a pretext. It was made at the same time the son was allowed back into the property by law. Okay, so the son retook possession of the property, not because of the rent demand. He took possession of the property, notwithstanding the rent demand.
Is there any evidence, Mr. Ali, in the record, though, that would suggest that if he'd have paid the rent, he could not have stayed there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The point being, when you say a sham, is it not true? There's nothing in the record to suggest that if he'd have handed his father $1,200, he would at least be able to stay there 30 days from that point, correct?
Well, at that point, he would have ratified or agreed to or acquiesced to the rent demand.
The tenancy, I just was responding. I was trying to understand your point about the sham.
Well, the sham is, let me put it this way, right? The rent demand was made not for the purpose of collecting rent, but for the purpose of setting the son up so the father then could file eviction action number 2, right? What if he had demanded $12 million, right? The amount doesn't matter. I'm sorry.
Just to clarify, though, your son spending any time there was from the gratuitous offer of dad to stay there, correct?
Let me say something about that, all right? As I've made clear, in the brief and here today. The issue whether a tenancy was existed is not before the court because it hasn't been appealed. But this concept of gratuitous and lack of consideration and a tenancy can't be created unless the would-be tenant is doing something on behalf of the landlord or for the benefit of the landlord, that's not in the law, right? A tenancy is a property interest. I can gift a property interest to someone else. My parents can gift me the home when they pass away, right? A property interest can be gifted, right? I wasn't good in property, but that much I remember from law school, all right? So this issue of, well, the kid wasn't doing anything for the father was doing this out of the goodness of his heart. That's a red herring. That's irrelevant. The father was allowing the son to live there as a resident.
Did the father have a right to charge the son for living there?
After 90 days, sure. He said, I'm giving you notice to vacate, right? You got to be out in 90 days or 3 months. I keep saying 90 days. The statute says 3 months. But alternatively, if you want to start paying me rent, you can stay.
So by reading the statute that way, your rent-free tenant actually has more rights than someone who has a lease and pays rent every 30 days?
Well, in terms of notice to vacate time, that's one way to characterize it, but—
Does it make sense? I mean, again, where is the law on—
Let me explain rent, why it does make sense.
Rent-free tenancies, you haven't given us any.
Let me explain why it does make sense. Victims of domestic abuse in a relationship all the time, right? One needs time to get out. Right? Or one forces the other to get out, and the other has to get his or her affairs together, get his or her things together to move. That's one situation. Another one—
But that isn't generally a landlord-tenant situation.
Well, it can be, right? If one person's on the mortgage and the other person's not, the law would apply in that situation. Let me give you another one. An adult child who has a disability, a severe disability. Can the father just go, or the parents just go, today, tomorrow you start paying $2,000 a month, or get out, with, say, a daughter in a wheelchair, an adult, right? There's a bunch of policy reasons why 3 months makes sense, but that's not the issue before the court. That would be the issue that the legislature should take up. My time's expired.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today as well as your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement. Have a good day.